Hello and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today I'm delighted to talk to Daniel of the Muslim Skeptic, who is in the UK for the first time. You're most welcome, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Well,
nice to meet you. Finally, this is the first time I've met Daniel in person, and your first visit to the UK.
Yes.
Well, we've got lovely English weather here. It's raining and miserable and cloudy. It's so embarrassing because you're from Texas, is that right? In the States. Fantastic. So you've been really busy, I think, in the UK so far. So what have you been up to? Where have you been?
Yeah, I've been visiting a lot of different parts of the UK.
Oh, yeah.
So I was in London, Birmingham. Birmingham, is that the correct pronunciation?
Birmingham. I think if you're there, it's Birmingham, but I call it Birmingham.
Okay, Birmingham. Yeah. Birmingham.
Because you have a Birmingham estates in Alabama, I think.
Yeah, Alabama. Yeah.
Is it different there? Yeah.
Different pronunciation, but also up north in Bradford, gave a talk. So, alhamdulillah, just visiting different mosques, visiting different parts of the UK community.
Right.
So, it's very nice.
One thing we were just discussing earlier, actually, is Muslims in the UK versus Muslims in America, because you noticed some quite big differences, did you, in terms of, you know, demographically, socioeconomically, and the terms of identity. Could you discuss that?
It seems to be that there's a lot of big differences between the community here and in America. There's a socioeconomic component. There's also a population density component. So you can go to many parts of the UK, and if you wanted to, you could only see Muslims going on the streets, and there'll be hijabis, women in niqab, just Muslims dressed traditionally. And there were some days that I didn't even see a non-Muslim.
Really?
Yeah, a whole day.
This must have been in Birmingham or Bradford,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So that you can't see that in the U.S. There's not that level of Muslim population density in certain areas. Yeah, you can go to in the big cities like in New York or L.A. There might be a street that has Muslim shops, but even in those streets, it's maybe 50% non-Muslim.
Yeah.
So that was something completely different about.
Is that because America is such a vast continent, isn't it? And I've been there, and it's huge. Whereas England's very small. You can fit like England in like Texas, probably, couldn't you? Quite easily.
Yes.
So obviously, we're concentrated in big cities here, like in the States.
So that's a big difference, but I mean, there seems to be like a different mentality as well. Over there, Muslims are more identity conscious in terms of assimilating or being viewed as American, being part of the American fabric, culturally, in terms of identity, whereas I didn't see as much of that in the UK. So I think that also affects the level of religiosity, or at least the outward adoption of religiosity in terms of going to the mosque,
right,
you know, dressing a certain way. That is a very noticeable difference as well.
So are you think British Muslims are more committed to the deen, perhaps, committed to Islam than...
Yeah, I would say that that's the case, you know, if we were to objectively measure.
Right.
UK, the way that it's described, usually, okay, they're more conservative.
Yeah.
They're more conservative. The way it's said pejoratively is that the UK is 10 years behind, you know, in terms of liberalization and assimilation. So that's how it's said pejoratively, like, oh, you're behind us, we're ahead in.
But it's the other way around, because I've often been told, you know, when I went to Birmingham, not Alabama, but Birmingham in the UK, that, you know, when the first big wave of Muslim immigrants came here like three generations ago, you know, they built the mosques and the halal restaurants and the infrastructure and so on. They weren't necessarily that practicing, and then their children became more practicing. But today, his youth in the UK are much more practicing than their parents or their grandparents.
Really?
So the trajectory is not towards liberalization, it's actually to a greater fidelity or adherence to the deen, actually. And this seems to be often the case in Europe, actually, not just here. I've heard that same in Scandinavia, Sweden, for example, Germany, France has big problems, but, you know, it's not towards liberalization in Europe anyway, so much.
That's interesting. I didn't know that history, but in the U.S. it's the complete opposite. Like the first wave of immigration, maybe in the 60s, was the biggest wave, and 70s, they were much more conservative than the second generation or the third generation.
That's stupid, because it's the opposite of what I'm hearing. And I've tried to get some reliable information about this, but everyone's telling me the same thing in different parts of the UK. And then I asked about the European experience from friends in Berlin and so on, saying, oh, it's the same thing. I mean, Dr. Abdullah Swedi from Sweden said exactly the same thing in Sweden. Well, we're seeing an increased adherence to the deen. You know, people are praying and during Ramadan, fasting, and so this is very interesting. So America might be the exception, actually.
How do they explain that?
Good question. And I've asked this. Some people say that the family, Muslim families, are quite strong in the UK. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we have parents and grandparents, and so on. The breakdown in the family has not really hit the Muslim family so much in the UK, and that helps to transmit the deen, the faith, from generation to generation. But also, I think we've got some amazing dawah guys. You know, we all know who the Sapiens Institute, we've got Mohammed Hijab, we've got Hamza Zortzis, and so on. I mean, these are huge influences, and people, young people, watch their stuff, their content, and presumably are inspired by it and learn from it, and obviously from your content as well. So there's not much kind of liberal modernist stuff around when it comes to social media. I don't know what you think.
Yeah,
in the UK, anyway.
Yeah, I'm not sure what could explain it. Maybe it's also the fact that Islamic schooling in the U.S. is few and far between. You do have Islamic schools, but they haven't really been prioritized in terms of funding or organization. Mm. There are good Islamic schools, but maybe the lack of Islamic schooling or like madrasa systems, like there are madrasas, but they're few and far between when you look at the entire land mass of the United States. Mm. Some cities have them, some cities don't. So that probably can have a big effect on religiosity. Mm-hmm. Maybe over here, the previous generation, they established the madrasa. They didn't necessarily attend the madrasa, but they put their kids in the madrasa, and that led to more religiosity generation over generation. It's strange because that also bucks the trend in other parts of the Muslim world. Other parts of the Muslim world, you see liberalization. All of these Muslim countries are becoming liberalized, and this is reflected in the breakdown of family, among other things. So, what an interesting counterintuitive phenomenon.
Yeah, but I spoke to Professor Linda Woodhead. She's Professor of Sociology of Religion at King's College here in London. She's an expert on, you know, demographics and faith and so on. And religion is declining in the UK. Absolutely. It's secularized, families breaking down, individualism and liberalization is rampant, except when it comes to Muslims. And this was her, you know, this is a recent census that was done earlier this year, and it's painting of a completely different, I mean, this is an extraordinary story. It's simply not happening the same way to Muslims. Muslims are growing in number and strength.
That's very, but I also, a big difference that I noticed between the US and the UK is that the government is much more overtly involved with the Muslim community in terms of monitoring programs. And I was shocked to hear that in some of the madrasas, the government requires that secular subjects be taught first before religious subjects.
What is this?
These are in just the madrasa systems, like the...
In which country?
Here.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so that this is shocking to me as an American, for the government to overtly dictate what a Islamic school, ostensibly private school, would teach, in what order. No, you have to prioritize the secular subjects. And apparently one madrasa that resisted the government mandate was taken to court by the government to force them to obey this. So that's shocking. Something like that wouldn't happen. So maybe to tie it back to the demographic point, like this is the Muslim community in the eyes of a secular regime is a much bigger threat you know, if we don't clamp down on this kind of increase in religiosity, that's going to have wide-ranging ramifications for the secular British values that we have.
No, I mean, absolutely. You know, the brother here is talking about Ofsted and the role of Ofsted in clamping down on the, this kind of thing. And, you know, it's certainly the case that, you know, the LGBT agenda and other agendas are being pushed hard in schools in general. And obviously Muslim children go to schools. So there is a real issue. I'm not saying it's all rosy, but there does seem to be a difference between the States and here and Europe. And Europe is very, France is very authoritarian.
Even more so than here.
In fact, throughout Europe, it's the same, pretty much. England seems to be different, or UK seems to be different, really, for some reason. For historical reasons, I suspect. But if possible, can we just change the subject, really, to what's on everyone's mind, and that is the conflict in the Middle East, in the occupied territories, in Gaza, but particularly because you've been very vocal on the Western media reporting of the conflict. And I've just been shocked, really, because I knew the West has a particular view, but the way everyone, be it governments, corporations, universities, media, seem to be in lockstep, in agreement to have one line only, and they're all coming up with the same rhetoric all the time, almost the same phrases, almost as if they've all met together in a room and said, we will have this single response. And the way dissent, obviously, is not given any space, airtime, really, with very few rare exceptions. And I've just been struck by this, how absolutely watertight this narrative is that we're all having to subscribe to. I mean, how is that the same in America for you? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, it's the same. It seems coordinated because it is coordinated.
Right.
They'll literally send media packets to different outlets, channels, and there'll be a literal script. You know, don't say, for example, that Palestinians were killed by Israelis. Say that Palestinians have died.
Yes.
You know, the passive voice. You know, these types of instructions. Never call it. Never describe Israel as an occupier or Palestine as an occupied state. Always frame the frame it as a conflict between two equal sides.
Right.
So these are deliberate instructions that are given and distributed by Zionist sources and the Israeli lobby. And this is well known. This is not something that they've just rolled out for the present situation. This is something that has been institutionalized for decades around reporting Israelis' aggression against the Palestinians. So, and this is not just this issue. All issues like liberal media, liberal secular media, I don't mean like left wing, but just, you know, secular media in general is mind control. Mm. And I actually taught a course on this at my institute on liberal mind control and how much control of the way that we think within of these liberal so-called democracies and how we are meant to view life in liberal society as a life of free thinking, free speech, you're free to explore different ideas, when in reality it's totalitarian control. Mm-hmm. And your thought is carefully engineered to align with a certain liberal paradigm. And this is the stark reality. We see the edges of it, or the most apparent aspects of it, when we notice that, oh, for example, there's a viral video or several viral videos of they've compiled news channels, local news channels, and they all will have the same exact line. Have you seen this?
Yes, I have. Yes. You see extracts from all these independent newsrooms all actually saying exactly the same thing, and you can see them all at the same time. So it really exposes the coordination, as you put it, of these people, and gives the lie to the idea of independent journalism in a free society when they're all singing from the same hymn sheet, quite literally.
Yeah.
But I mean, people like Noam Chomsky, the American writer, commentator, have been saying this before, of course, not
and
necessarily in the exactly, not just necessarily in the Muslim context, but in a more general American context. So this has been something that's been known, but now it's really very explicit and obvious. This is what struck me. It's like no pretense anymore at being neutral or independent, rather. It's like everyone's saying the same thing. It's remarkable.
Yeah, it might have not have been as obvious before because of lack of access to social media, or social media wasn't as robust and developed as it is in 2023. But in the past, if you just see, you know, if you're just consuming one or two news channels and they happen to have the similar talking points, it won't strike you as odd. But when you look at across the board, even internationally, everyone is saying the same thing, you know, all the establishment media saying the same thing, then it's more obvious that there's coordination happening. The other important contrast, I think, is that when it comes to the supporters of Palestine, they also have aligned talking points, but there is no coordination. Like, people are saying the same thing. Why? Because it's based on reality. It's, the truth has this character of uniting people in that way. So, but what, if you have to spread a lie, then that requires a great deal of coordination. It requires cooking the books, so to speak, as opposed to those who are just speaking the truth, or they see what's happening and they're denouncing it, or they're reporting it as it really is.
So I want to ask you this. I mean, you're the founder of Muslim Skeptic, muslimskeptic.com. Apart from your own platform, which is part of an answer to my question, what other news sources, independent sources of information and news, can people access that you recommend, other than your own, obviously your own platform? But what else should Muslims and other people who want to think for themselves, what other go-to sources should they look at, do you think?
Honestly, I go to my Twitter feed, and that's my source of news at this point.
But why Twitter? What's unique about Twitter that is your go-to source?
Twitter has experienced, this might be controversial, but Twitter has experienced this revival, in my opinion, since Elon Musk has bought it out. And there is much less overt control over what is allowed to be said on that platform. I was actually banned from Twitter, and in what I believe was a politically motivated...
I didn't realize. Gosh.
Oh, yeah. I was off of Twitter for... You didn't notice I was gone? Thanks, Paul.
Oh, no. I've been so consumed by my own things. But sorry. So was it because when Musk came on, that's when the great return happened? People can...
So Musk, returned my account, reinstated my account.
Amazing.
And before, if I posted something that was contrary to a mainstream Democrat left-wing narrative, I would get penalized for that on the platform, even though it didn't involve hate speech, didn't involve any kind of illegal speech or any calls to violence. It was still very, very tight
political
control.
Censorship.
Now that Musk is in control, he's eased that, and I don't think it's perfect, but it's much more open to debate and dialogue and challenging the status quo, challenging official narratives, even like boosting versus deboosting. So on the old platform, you might not get overtly banned.
So shadow banned.
But you're shadow banned, or your post is deboosted if it's promoting something that is contrary to the official status quo.
Yeah.
Whereas that seems to have been minimized, or it's gone away.
Yeah.
That's my perspective. Maybe others have a different perspective.
No, I've noticed, but on the downside, there's some, I mean, I won't mention the name, I don't want to give them any publicity, but there's some far-right groups in the UK that now have a very substantial following. They were banned before, and now they've got a platform to promote their views, and it's always anti-Islamic, and these days often just pro-Zionist as well, paradoxically, because historically they've been quite anti-Jewish, but now they're not. I mean, there are exceptions.
Yeah.
So like everyone's now on board.
Even those right wingers, like the far right white nationalist types, the ones that are anti-Islam, it's very easy to rebut them. So whereas if they're banned, sometimes they can just operate and grow without being confronted or without being debunked. But when you actually see what they're saying, it's not much substance there, or it's easily refuted. I don't view that as a big cost to the bigger benefit of just having a more open platform. So I'm not a free speech absolutist.
No.
By any means, but I think that there's a better balance now than before.
No, I agree. That's been my experience as well. Although it's not the case, in my view, on Facebook and perhaps on Instagram. Facebook particularly seems
Facebook
old
is the
regime. It's like I'll ban you for having a...
Yeah, for sneezing in the wrong direction, they'll ban you.
No, I had this about a year and a half ago. The Blogging Theology Facebook group was simply shut down, and I was told it was shut down for security concerns.
Wow.
So I said to them, why? What? Oh, we can't tell you. Can I? And they said, you have no right of appeal.
Wow.
And it was like, I couldn't do anything. I couldn't ask why. And they just said it had been shut down for security. I mean, seriously, this is Blogging Theology on Facebook. So I just restarted it up again. I went to another site, put in the same details, a different email address. Now I'm exposing my secrets. But because it was outrageous, because there was no sense of justice or sense of fair play or sense of appeal or anything. And I hadn't done anything wrong. I mean, obviously, you know what BT is. I mean, what are we going to say that's going to scare anyone? But we offended.
I don't know.
Well,
quite edgy. Quite an edgy platform.
You reckon? Don't tell anyone. But no, I whatever the reason was, they shut it down. But no, YouTube doesn't seem to be, well, it doesn't seem to be quite so risque, but you've voiced concerns about your
YouTube,
presence on
definitely.
YouTube.
Yeah, YouTube also. I don't think they're bad as Facebook, but they're not as good as Twitter.
No.
Did you follow the Twitter files? That was one of the things that Musk revealed that the U.S. government in particular is overtly involved, directly involved in having meetings with these platforms and saying, oh, well, we want this account banned, we want this account banned. Yeah. So it wouldn't be surprising if governments are telling these platforms. It's actually not in the interest of the platforms. Mm. The platforms benefit from having big channels that are talking about controversial subjects, because that increases engagement and increases time that people have on the platform. Mm. I actually don't have, I'll be on Twitter and going through that feed. It's connected to the lack of censorship. I don't bother with Facebook because it's so boring and bland.
Yeah.
Everything interesting has been censored for security reasons.
Yeah.
So the platform kills itself with that level of censorship that they've undertaken. You just go to Facebook for what?
For family photographs and
family
birthdays
photos.
And whatever.
That wasn't how Facebook was in the past. In the past, there were a lot of very controversial topics being discussed and debated, and it was interesting. Let's see what so-and-so has to say. It was a kind of public space for debate.
Mm.
But that's been absolutely killed because one side of the debate is just overtly censored. But Twitter now has, I think, taken that mantle up and is upholding that in a much better way.
Yeah. So in terms of supporting the Palestinians and all that whole cause on Twitter, do you reckon it's an open space, or is there still... I support Hamas, presumably, on Twitter. One couldn't say that, or can one say that?
You might be able to say that.
Really? Okay.
Outright.
Right,
if someone were inclined to say that, they could... they could probably say that. I don't know of any cases where they've been overly banned.
Yeah. Gosh, well, that is very, very open.
Yeah. I mean, some of the videos they will put, some of the activists were noting this, that if you put a gruesome photo of some Israeli person who has been harmed, then that will be boosted. But if it's a Palestinian, they'll put a censorship warning, sensitive content, and it'll be de-boosted. Some have pointed out that maybe that's a double standard. I haven't confirmed it, but it's not necessarily 100% even-handed as we would like, but it's miles better than both Facebook and YouTube.
Right, because I know Musk himself says he no longer consumes the, or reads the, there's a legacy media, he calls it. He just has, which presumably is like CNN and BBC, whatever. He doesn't read it anymore. He said it on the tweet once, which was remarkable considering his, running Twitter and all that. I know the Gaza, the situation in Gaza is particularly awful, but what can we do as just ordinary Muslims or ordinary people generally to what do you see as our strategy, our role here? Do we just keep publicizing it or refuting the narrative or pushing back against the lies or the language that's used? I mean, do you have a kind of a strategy about this?
There's a strategy, of course, that we have to, you know, take the means, or asbab, as it's said in Arabic, like we take the means that are in front of us for opposing evil. And this is actually coming from the statement of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, that if you see an evil, change it with your hand. If you're not able to do so, change it with your tongue. Mm-hmm. If you're not able to do so, then hate it with your heart, and that's the lowest level of iman.
Yeah.
And that kind of philosophy or mindset, that we do as much as we can, and that comes from a spiritual place. Like, you actually have to hate evil, you have to hate injustice, and but what are the actual means that you can take to oppose those things? So in our situation, or from the situation of most Muslims around the world, it's speaking out. And we should not consider this to be a small thing. Mm. Speaking out can have has had a great impact, and many have noted with this current situation that Israel has lost the information war.
Wow.
And that is not because the major legacy media channels or the big tech companies have supported the Palestinian cause. Mm. It's because of individual accounts and just a mass, millions of people going online and demanding justice, pointing out the hypocrisy, pointing out the atrocities of this terror state. So that's, that voice has a major, major impact. And when they survey different countries in the world that have very little to do with Israeli or Palestinian politics,
Yeah. They're
overwhelmingly on the Palestinian side.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so the thing that really stuck out to me last week was that they polled the Chinese online. And we know that the Communist Party is not necessarily the biggest fan of Muslims, but as for the Chinese people, they 99% believe that Palestine was the victim and Israel is the aggressor. So, and this is in Latin America also, you see many accounts that will be flying the Palestinian flag.
And
you
know, some of the leaders of some of these nations in South America have spoken very vocally in support of the Palestinians.
Yeah.
I forget which ones, Venezuela perhaps or something.
Brazil, Argentina,
Right.
African nations as well. So this is Israel losing the information war. They don't really have support, popular support in the global sense. Mm. Even in Western countries, even amongst Jews, even amongst Western Jews, there is, amongst the younger generations, there's decreasing support of the Zionist project overall. And this has become a crisis for Israel, because they have programs to groom, you could say, the youth to support Zionism, birthright trips, for example, where they'll take university Jewish students, and this is your birthright, let's go to Israel, and they'll tour, they'll have a nice vacation.
What happened to the birthright of Palestinians who are refugees and no longer, you know, the right of return? I always bring it up with, I won't mention their names, there's a few Jewish people I know, and they're just not interested in having a conversation about the right of return of the Palestinians. You know, this is their homeland. They only want it, you know, but the Jewish people, if they're born anywhere in the world and might have been the 100th generation going back in that country, simply have a right of return, so to speak, to Palestine, the occupied. It's extraordinary. It's actually hard to believe, really. You think in a modern world that this kind of logic would exist. But it does, and it's legal, and it's supported by the West. You know, we stand with Israel, as they all say in lockstep, the same language, all of them together.
Right.
I don't know, it's just...
Yeah, it's all a big propaganda game, but good news is that it's the lies come out eventually, and people wake up.
But on that very point, that there was this attack on the hospital in Gaza, and we had this IDF recording, alleged recording of... Hamas, you know, fighters allegedly saying, "Oh, well, we admit that we hit the hospital." And the people I know who are Arabs or speak Arabic fluently have clearly identified this as a fake, because the people speaking on this are not comedians; they're not real. They have no authenticity about them, and it's very obvious apparently that it's not authentic. But that's a direct result of social media listening to this and responding to it and exposing it and saying this is a joke. We can't take this seriously. No way is this too palatable. You know, this is not authentic, and so this has backfired, and purely because of social media, I think.
Yeah, what's shocking is not that Israel is trying to fake images, fake audio, even fake video. That's not the shocking thing. The shocking thing is that their fakes are so bad. Because they're, even myself, like on social media, there are people who try to fake, like create fake audio of me speaking using AI. And that those fakes are more convincing than what Israel is putting out. So that's the shocking thing as far as I'm concerned. Or there was the fake image that Ben Shapiro put out of the alleged charred remains of a baby. Yeah, it's disturbing until you find, you know, there's expert analysis done that points out that this is a complete fake AI generated image. And Ben Shapiro never retracted that. He never made a clarification. They just, that's the brazen thing about it. They lie and then they stand by the lie. Mm-hmm. And the way that I describe it is that they know that you know that they're lying. You know, they know they're lying. They know that you know that they're lying. Yeah. They know that you know that they're lying, but they still, you know, proceed in the most aggressive, shameless way. Like a normal person, if you're brazenly lying, there are certain indications, like you might avert your eyes, or you might like fidget, or like there's some indicators, or touch your nose. Like there's a tell. But they're very aggressive with their lies, as if they fully believe it. Like they live in a completely different world than the rest of humanity.
I mean, just lastly, I want to slightly change the subject because I just can't resist. I wanted, because meeting you for the first time, you had that amazing debate or dialogue. You, Jake, Robert Spencer, and guy, person called Brother Rashid, on YouTube, and I forget how many millions of hits this has got now. But I mean, talk about going viral, and that was a masterclass. You and Jake, and so very much grateful for what you did there, the way you countered the narrative, particularly Robert. Well, both of them, Robert Spencer and this guy, Brother Rashid. But I mean, well, what's your takeaway from that? I mean, what I mean, it was brilliant. You, I mean, I've been itching for someone to respond to Robert Spencer with that kind of classy intellectual pushback for a long time, because he gets away with a lot as well, doesn't he? In the States, and I'm just wondering, you know, what are your reflections post debate on what happened there? I mean, is Robert Spencer a credible figure anymore, even in his own circles, or has he now been quietly, embarrassingly kind of thing? Let's move on from him.
Yeah, I mean, he has no presence or following online other than Indian accounts, like Indian Hindutva. So, if you took out the that Hindutva factor, those Indian accounts,
which is a big thing, by India's a massive,
it's a huge country, you know, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of accounts that just flood, and they've done analysis on this, like most of the Islamophobia or anti-Muslim speech on social media comes from India. So how is that? France is another one, but I don't think he really has any kind of following or presence. It's just artificially generated.
Right.
And he's been irrelevant for a long time. He just has avoided confronting Muslims face to face in a debate. I've challenged him multiple times before over the past 2 years, because his website has published multiple articles about me, denouncing me as an extremist, etc. And I've confronted him directly. Like, he'll post the article on his Twitter and I'll reply, and he'll get ratioed with my reply, saying that, okay, Robert, you clearly find me worthy of deconstruction and critique. Why not just confront me face to face and explain to me how I'm an extremist or how I'm this or that? And he just flatly refused, ignores.
Wow.
So this, you know, this becomes a strategy to essentially bully these bullies. If you want to write about me, then you should be able to talk to me face to face and show me up and debunk my views, debunk Islam. But you avoid that, and their follower, it's demoralizing for their followers. Their followers see that challenge and they see the silence from Robert. So that's, but for this Patrick Bet-David, he had no choice. He wanted to get on that large platform, even at the risk of being exposed. But I was shocked at how poorly he prepared. I mean, I didn't expect much from that brother, Rashid, whatever his name is.
It was very emotional, very, coming back to the same kind of line all the time, rhetorically, emotionally kind of loaded statements he would make. But, you know, that was, you know, to do it once, okay, but to keep on coming back with his rhetoric.
Yeah, it was quite pathetic.
Yeah, it wasn't that great.
But, yeah, Spencer should have been more capable. For what we were going to say, like, did he really expect to bring up, you know, apostasy in Islam and the different penal code or punishments in Islam, and then we would have no response? I think that's what he expected. He said, oh, well, in Islam you have this punishment, therefore, you know, explain it. Oh, you can't, can you? You can't explain it, therefore. But that's in other debates that I've had with Christians, I'll point out that, look, you have the same laws in the Bible.
Well, this is I love the way you push back. You say, Robert, I'm not sure, I'm paraphrasing you, of course, if I'm debating a liberal secularist or even an atheist here, because that's the position that even fundamentalist Christians, in my experience, the Speaker's Corner, they come from this kind of assumption that liberal secular modernity is their baseline when it comes to all of these issues. But they're fundamentalist Christians as well. They have the highest view of the Bible as the Word of God. And I think, excuse me, you know, your criticism of Islam is completely void. What are you? Are you going to be a liberal secularist or a Christian? Choose your ground. But they always choose the secular ground because it's the more powerful one in their view, because they're in tune with the Western zeitgeist. So they've got this kind of axiomatic worldview that we all inhabit, they think. They don't argue from the Bible because they can't, because there's no objection then, you know. So that was a rhetorical move. I like that, very juicy. And I thought, wow, you know, who am I debating? Oh,
yeah. Exactly. This is all of the Christian debaters are like this. Their apologists are all just taking for granted liberalism, secularism, feminism. They take it for granted, and that's the basis on which they critique Islam. But their own books, their own religious tradition, their own church is undermined by those same critiques. So it's like a, you know, it's, for lack of a better term, like a suicide mission. They want to just take themselves out. They want to take Muslims out by taking themselves out. But other religions are similar, like Hinduism. You see Jewish interlocutors also. So Buddhist, in some cases, they have this kind of attack of Islam on the basis that it is not pro-woman enough, it is not pro-democracy enough, it is not pro-free speech enough, pro-LGBT enough. That's their main criticism of Islam. They don't criticize Islam on the basis of their own religious doctrines. Like, I could respect a Buddhist more who says that, well, I do not agree with Islam because Islam doesn't have the concept of reincarnation, and reincarnation is just a more rational position to have. I would have more respect for that. Or even the Christians who will argue that, well, I do not agree with Islam because it doesn't have this kind of Trinitarian concept, which is more rationally compelling somehow. That is more respectable than someone who says that, oh, Islam doesn't have separation of church and state, or separation of mosque and state, therefore it's false. Like, where in your own books is this concept enshrined, other than like a projection of the liberal concept onto your books, which some Muslims do as well, incorrectly. But yeah, that's the nature of these interfaith debates, and it makes it very easy for the Muslim debater, because you're just arguing liberalism. You're debating against liberalism, and there are a few arguments that you need to learn, and you can debate any religious group on that basis. They're just going to put their own flavor on it, their own Christian flavor, Jewish flavor, Hindu flavor, but ultimately it's the same debate over and over and over again.
And of course, what this means, of course, is that Islam is the only major world religion, I think, anywhere now, that is retaining the integrity of its fundamental beliefs, the Quran and the Sunnah. It's not capitulated, generally speaking, to the zeitgeist or Western political ideological agendas. Now, there are one or two individual exceptions, but they seem to be very marginal figures, marginal
increase increasingly so. Increasingly so, they're being marginalized by Muslim. Well, we're just talking about the UK becoming the younger generations becoming more religiously committed. So, in the past, you'd find these liberal Muslims advocating for religious reform, etc. They had a much greater influence. I think it was because of government funding as well.
Yes,
a lot of them were government funded, but there seems to be a they've been marginalized to a great deal. It's because their arguments aren't very compelling. This is why I appreciate a lot of what you do, Paul, with Blogging Theology, is you establish, you do a lot of textual criticism of the Bible, and that is a very valuable service for Muslims and non-Muslims, because it shows that, well, if you don't really have a preserved text, then it becomes much easier to reform, because you really can make excuses that, well, we can adopt secularism and liberalism and all of these other isms because there is a text, but the text has shown all kinds of signs of corruption or being modified. And that's actually a liberal critique. Like, that's what Orientalism originally was founded on. The Orientalists wanted to apply the textual criticism of the Bible to the Quran in order to undermine the Quran in the way that the Bible had been undermined.
Yeah.
So that's a way to secularize a religious population, is to show that population that, oh, see, the books that you thought were from God are actually man-made. So why would you? That has a big impact on undermining a person's faith.
Yeah.
They haven't been able to do that in the same way with the Quran, and so that prevents the secularization. It prevents liberalization. Mm. Muslims, you know, if you say to a Muslim, oh, well, you should adopt secularism, they'll say, oh, well, we have these hadith, we have these verses of the Quran, and they are completely contradicting a secular ideology or worldview. And the response can't be, oh, well, these are man-made things because we see the distortion. We bring two manuscripts from the time, 1400 years ago, and they have significant differences, and they are just completely edited and what have you. There hasn't been that kind of result from the Orientalist project.
No, and we now have, the University of Birmingham, it was uncovered just a couple of years ago, a Quran that comes from the time of the Prophet himself, upon him be peace, which has been carbon dated, and it's exactly the same as modern Qurans. And I often say to Christians, perhaps in a more polemical context, speakers, I say, how many manuscripts of the New Testament do you have from the first Christian century? And the answer is zero, of course. The second Christian century, it's actually just a credit card fragment of John's Gospel, third century. And, and then I say to them, well, what's the earliest complete New Testament we have in the world? What's the earliest manuscript? It's the 4th century AD, 400 years after the birth of Jesus, upon him be peace.
Codex
Sinaiticus and the Codex Vaticanus. Codex Sinaiticus is here in London in the British Library, which we think is the oldest in the world, but there's one in the Vatican, the Codex Vaticanus, approximately the same date. Both mid-4th century, and that's the earliest complete New Testament we have in the world in Greek. So what a difference. And we have now 100% of the Quran apparently in manuscript form in various manuscripts throughout the world, dating back to the time of the Prophet himself.
Yeah. And the fact that it's in Greek, because...
It's not even the language of Jesus. But it was written by people who didn't know Jesus. The Gospels are not even eyewitness accounts, according to the Christians' own scholars. And yet we have a very robust hadith criticism when it comes to Sahih Hadith. We have the Quran is intact, and that is the consensus of Western scholars now. The Quran we have today is the same Quran that the Sahaba knew, for example, and that's the majority. There are one or two people disagree with that, but mainly Western scholars now accept that, and obviously Muslims do too. So game over. That's it. The only issue now is what you say. Secularism and how we respond to the message. The message is intact. Actually, that's remarkable. That's almost unique amongst the world religions, I think.
Yeah. One thing that I've been looking into this past year and doing more research on is how these Orientalists, Orientalist is now taken as pejorative, but we can say Islamic studies academics, they have shifted their focus from the Quran to Hadith. and attacking the preservation of Hadith, and they don't acknowledge that this is a big back step that they've made, because their original claims were that the Quran was something that medieval.
I remember it's like two or three centuries after the time of the Prophet, apparently, the Quran was compiled, and people like Jay Smith, I mentioned his name, you know, the American missionary, still trot out this line, but it's completely destroyed. No one believes it now. But they did in the past, you're right.
Yeah, they believe, like Patricia Crona, for example, and Cook, Michael Cook, they had this view that even the figure of the Prophet Muhammad, this is just a made up figure. You have Hagarism, you have a different, Islam as is known is just the invention of medieval Muslims. So that has been completely been debunked. The claim that the Quran is just a compilation of different Arabic literature translated from Aramaic sources or Syriac sources, that's been completely debunked because of the things like the Birmingham manuscript. But now they've shifted their focus to Hadith. We're not able to really get the Muslims in the same way we got Christianity or Judaism. We'll have to go to the Hadith literature. But even there, I think that they're not really going to be successful.
No.
But I think Muslims, there needs to be an effort to debunk their claims against Hadith. I attempted to do some of this with a debate that I had with one of these academics from Harvard. You might have seen it. We had like a nearly 7-hour debate.
Wow.
Yeah.
7-hour debate.
So that was a debate on the certain values within Islam. So he, as an academic, claimed that these values regarding patriarchy, for example, values regarding sexual ethics, values regarding secularism, things regarding religious freedom, these were or restrictions on religious freedom. These are things that were invented after. Well after the Prophet Muhammad, and they're not authentic to the religion. Therefore, he happens to be like a modernist, so he has his own agenda beyond just academic objectivity. So he was making that argument, and in that debate, I used non-Hadith sources to prove that, what the Hadith record about patriarchy, non-Western style secular religious freedom, etc., that is, it's more plausible historically, using the historical critical method, that was taught by the Prophet, peace be upon him. That's actually what the Prophet believed. So that's also something that's shared with Western, non-Muslim academics. They'll say, of course, Islam, like the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, was a patriarchal and had patriarchal views. Of course, and just on the basis of other historical sources, other religions of the time. Of course, they obviously have the secular perspective. They don't believe that it's been revealed, but they're not going to question that. Mm-hmm. It's only a reformist who says that, no, this is a later accretion. This is something later that was invented. But the argument really breaks down when you do look at the historical sources other than Hadith. The historical sources corroborate the authenticity of the Hadith.
I mean, I got this marvelous new translation of Al-Muwatta by Malik, from Medina. It's been produced from the sponsored by the Moroccan government, I think. And, but people often say, not Muslims, but polemicists say, your Hadith were written down, two or three centuries after, only in Bukhari do we have these Hadith being written down. And excuse me, we got Al-Muwatta, which is much earlier. And I think it's something like 33% or 36% of the Sahih Hadith in Bukhari come from directly from Al-Muwatta, Malik's book, which is, he knew people who knew the Sahaba. I mean, he was this golden chain. This is this expression that Bukhari uses. The three, just basically three people going back to the Muhammad. Very solid, reliable means of transmission, which is authenticated. We know all about these people, where they met, how they met, and they're reliable, as I say. And there are hundreds and hundreds of reliable Hadith like that just in Muwatta alone. And I'm an amateur, and I can see this. I mean, it's documented, and we have the Muwatta in manuscript form from the time of Malik himself as being carbon dated. It's not like a later theory. This is, we actually have, you know, we can actually read the Moiety in its original language in his handwriting that's been carbon dated.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it gets earlier and earlier and earlier, and these fantastic claims that only two or three centuries later were these hadith written down. No, they weren't. They were written down much earlier right. than that, just in the Moiety alone.
Right.
And that's not the only early source. There are others. So,
yeah.
Extraordinary.
Yeah, it's the manuscripts are being discovered that really are pushing back the objective confirmed dates.
Yeah.
So it seems like it's only a matter of time, but even independent sources, because one question you have, some of these academics who were claiming that, like the Shahada, La ilaha illallah, there's no God except Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. That is some, the second part of it, that Muhammad is his messenger, that was added later in later generations. That wasn't part of the original Shahada. And because in the Quran, it's not clear, this is what they claim, it's not clearly in the Quran that this is a one of the testimony, like this is part of the testimony of faith. But now independent sources, rock inscriptions. So what these companions of the Prophet, peace be upon him, would do, and other Arabs, Muslims at the time, it was, you could call it like graffiti, but they would make markings in different stone structures or like mountainside or cliffside. They would make these inscriptions. Maybe you've had interviews with some of these academics who specialize in that, but they found, you know, they found rock inscriptions of the Shahada that date to the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him. So this is something that's independent of hadith, but it's something that's physically verifiable. You can date it and place it at that point in history. All of these sources corroborate the traditional narrative and the traditional understanding of hadith and what the hadith are putting forward.
Yeah.
And as time goes on, as more of this data is collected, the direction that it's moving is to actually confirm that what Muslims are practicing and what they believe, the beliefs and norms of Muslims, are actually completely accurately preserved from the time of the Prophet. But this contradicts, like, this is a big blow to this liberal secular project.
I say unfortunately, but it is the case in Christianity. It's actually the other way around. For example, I remember for years I was told that this fragment of John's Gospel, which is in the John Rylands Library in Manchester University, actually, which I've seen, a credit card sized fragment, the Gospel of John, was dated to about 125 AD. So it's pretty early. It's still not first century. But actually, in recent years, the dating of it has been pushed much later, actually, and it's now mid to late second century. So it's no longer as early as they thought. And that is our earliest text, the New Testament. So it's exactly the opposite momentum, is actually to date these things later and later in Christianity. And so we don't have here no first century manuscripts at all for Christianity. But as you say, well, I've spoken to some experts on my channel. You know, there's lots of discoveries, not just inscriptions on rocks, as you say, and cliff faces in Saudi Arabia, mentioning the Sahaba, dated right back to the time of Sahaba, you know, obviously confirming they existed. There's archaeological evidence. And also the manuscript tradition is still a lot of stuff out there that's not been properly classified, but it all corroborates an earlier and earlier date. Very interesting movement. So this shouldn't be happening by the Orientalist narrative. It shouldn't really be happening like that, but it is.
Another example is, imagine you read in hadith that the Muslims were instructed to, at a certain point, the Qibla was changed.
Yes.
You know, from Jerusalem to Mecca or to the Kaaba, there was a change in orientation of the Qibla. So you might think, okay, well, the only way to verify this is we have to look at the chain, we have to corroborate every link in the chain. Maybe there could be a manuscript somewhere that we can date to the time of the Prophet or shortly after. But there is another way. You can do archaeology and you can see the foundations of some of these Masajid from 1400 years ago. You can date that, you can carbon date that or radiocarbon date it and see, oh, okay, there was a shift in the Qibla and that would corroborate the hadith.
Gosh.
So things like that, or burial practices of Muslims. You read hadith that say that, well, Muslims who are buried, they need to be have a kafan, you know, a certain cloth that they are wearing, and they should be buried in orientation facing the qibla.
Exactly.
That's something that archaeology can actually verify, and you can date it. And so that corroborates the hadith.
I didn't know about that. Yeah.
If you have enough of that type of corroboration, then it becomes much more plausible beyond like the internal tools that Muslims have traditionally, like mutawatir, like something is mass transmitted, this chain has been preserved, and we have an internal hadith criticism.
Yeah.
These academics are skeptical of all of that. They say, well, of course Muslims are going to claim that their sources are corroborating. I think they're wrong about that. I think there is plausibility that you can use mathematically to show that it is plausible that these hadith have been maintained since the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him. But even beyond that, if we look at these archaeological sources, we look at manuscript sources, rock inscriptions, even coinage, coins have been found as well, all of that together makes a very strong case, arguably a definitive case, that the hadith tradition is accurate in describing the time of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his teachings, his beliefs, and his norms.
Mm. And there's also an internal coherence about his teaching as well. There's a distinctive voice, I think, of the Prophet, Muhammad, even in English, when it's translated, there's a sense of it, the way he speaks, the style, very recognizable, I think, and very beautiful, actually.
Well, are you aware of the forensic analysis that's been done
in Turkey? Was that
it might have been Turkey, it might have been an Arab computer or linguist.
Maybe in Turkey or not. They actually processed this in software to see, they compared the Quran with the authentic hadith to see if it came from the same voice, the same human voice, and they found it wasn't possible, they were completely different.
Yeah, because this is also used in Shakespeare analysis.
Oh.
You know, because what is the true identity of Shakespeare? Mm. And was there some other figure who was writing as Shakespeare under a pseudonym?
Right.
And we can compare texts, like we can compare Shakespeare to the writing of some candidate, possible Shakespeare. It's assumed that the person who's writing as Shakespeare is going to try to hide his style and try to mimic something else in order to copy Shakespeare or to write, be a playwright.
Yeah.
But the forensic analysis is supposed to be able to beat, that type of mimicry or that attempt to deceive.
Yeah.
And so they've applied that same kind of forensic analysis to the Quran versus the Hadith.
Yeah.
And there's no way, probabilistically, that the author of the Quran could also be the author of Hadith.
The speech patterns, although there's very subtle things that would betray authorship, haven't anyway made that. Yeah,
exactly.
So it's extraordinary.
Yeah, that's what forensics is about. Like, they do it with handwriting as well.
Yeah.
Like, the serial killer writes a note, and he'll try to
pretend to be someone else, but
forensics will pick that up.
Yeah.
Same when it comes to speech and writing.
But of course, the Muslims are not going to be surprised at that, because that's what they believe anyway. But the challenge there is for other people to explain, how on earth do you account for this then?
Yeah.
The evidence suggests it's not, they come from different sources. So I suppose you say, some other human being wrote the Quran, but then that creates far more problems than it solves, really. Like, who else would have done it? Well, who's this mystery candidate? But
it starts stretching plausibility.
Okay, well, perhaps in conclusion, I'm dying to ask about the future of Muslim Skeptic and your own work. Do you have a great plan for the future? Daniel's going to be doing X next. Do we have any new initiatives on the horizon, perhaps?
Some new initiatives are trying to really expand and improve everything that we're already doing.
Right.
So we are doing a lot of debates Inshallah, we're going to continue that. We do a lot of deep dive analysis on different topics. Like we recently had a video debunking this idea that jihad allows for terrorism. The concept of jihad in Islam actually condones terrorism according to the classical sources, which is what some groups today have claimed, terror groups. We completely debunk that.
No, I mean, terrorism has been the word's not there, but the concept, the idea is being clearly prohibited by the Sharia from the beginning. It's a serious crime, a capital crime even. So this idea that terrorism is compatible is refuted by all the classical texts. It's simply not possible.
Yeah. So we, you know, that kind of research, we want to just basically, people already say that Muslim skeptic is like a think tank. But we want to really start to formalize it and become like an actual full-blown think tank with researchers and putting out books. We have a book actually that is been written through research, researchers coming together on liberal mind control. I taught a course on it, but we actually have like a 100-page book that we hope to publish under this think tank. So Muslim Skeptic as a think tank, that is the bigger vision, and we're working towards that step by step. And everyone who's interested can support. You know, we're 100% donation funded. We don't have any.
You don't have government funding.
Governments are
funny enough.
Surprisingly not supporting our research.
FBI is not funding you, no. But what you're doing, it overlaps considerably, though, with the Sapience Institute, it seems. They have a UK presence. Sorry, a US presence as well, I should say. There seems to be an awful lot of overlap, though, in terms of being a think tank, producing courses, critiquing liberalism, producing books, debates, and so on. So these are two powerhouses now working in tandem.
Yeah, absolutely. They're doing a lot of great work. Putting out a lot of great material. Everyone should really watch and consume their material and support them. So we're trying to do our part as well.
No, you're doing an extraordinary job. So inshallah, you will go from success to success. Well, I think that's probably good. I think it's been 1 hour. So thank you very much indeed, Daniel. And good to see you in England and Texan in London. So
yeah, it's beautiful meeting you finally and getting to spend this time with you. So appreciate you very much, Paul.
No, fantastic. Until next time. Thank you very much, Daniel. Take care.